This is a Pinball News production.
Right, thank you, Ron. Appreciate that. And I'm Larry Zartarian. I'm the board chair of the Pacific Pinball Museum in Alameda, California. And I'm delighted here today to be presenting with our executive director, Michael Sheese, who I'm sure all of you are familiar with. It was really Mike's vision, almost 10 years ago, that started this whole pinball extravaganza, I think, and started out as a Lucky Juju pinball gallery, and it's expanded and grown into what it is today. What we want to talk about today, as Ron said, is we really want to give you a taste of what our goals and our aspirations and our vision of the future is. I think it makes a lot of sense, though, to if you really want to understand your present and your future, you got to look at your past and see how you got there in context. It'll really reveal a lot about where you're going and give you a better understanding. But I think a lot of you know what our mission statement is, and that is to inspire an interest in science, art, and history through pinball, and to preserve and promote pinball machines as an important example of American pop culture. I think you all realize how uniquely American pinball really is as a phenomenon. I mean, there are other manufacturers, but really the genesis and I think the core of the manufacturing was all pretty much a uniquely American phenomenon. Just real briefly of where we are now, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with a board of directors. There's 12 folks. It's a very eclectic group. We have white collar, blue collar, no collar, some very talented, some very passionate and energetic folks on the board. And also, just by way of extension, putting on this Pacific Pinball Expo each year, we have a list of 115 volunteers that help us out with this. And it really wouldn't work on that level without the volunteers and the help of all the people that make this possible. So we really appreciate that. The first venue is the Pacific Pinball Museum itself at Santa Clara and Webster Street in Alameda. We have room in the current space for about 100 machines set on free play at any given time. We try to rotate out different games just to keep the lineup fresh. We have about 800 machines in our collection. But again, only room for about 100 set up and playable at one time. We do have the Lucky Juju Art Gallery, where we have exhibits related to pinball and sometimes not related to pinball. That's interesting to see. Of course, the Pacific Pinball Exposition. This is our fifth annual here in 2011. And then the Little Juju Mobile Pinball Museum that I'm sure a lot of you have seen, which is a 1947 Spartan Manor trailer equipped with no fewer than about 7 or 8 games and a jukebox. Okay. 6 smaller games and a functioning jukebox. Again, we're dedicated to, we really want to preserve pinball art, science, and history. And what we're doing is really unique in the sense that there are other efforts by groups to put together so-called museums around the country and around the world. But I think it's pretty safe to say that we are the only ones that are really emphasizing art, science, and history all under one roof. The other efforts, I think, can be characterized as arcades, more or less. Some of them coined, some of them a pay admission model. But I don't think the other efforts are really including the educational aspect of what we're trying to do. Just real briefly, I think you realize how we started out as the Lucky Juju Museum and Art Gallery back in 2002. At that time, you know, it was pretty much open 2 nights a week, Friday and Saturdays. We had a little donation jar out in front, and you could bring your own ice chest and cooler for drinks. And it was very low-key, sort of speakeasy kind of vibe. And I think a lot of people still appreciate that. That's one of the things that makes us unique. Just real briefly, what we're trying to do, as I kind of touched on already, but what we really want to do is not just become an arcade, but an actual arcadium. That is, we want to entertain and educate at the same time. And what we don't want is to have games that are behind velvet ropes or bulletproof glass that you just look at but don't touch. These games are made to be played and enjoyed, and we want that hands-on kinetic experience, but like what you're getting today here at the expo. And again, it's really important that we preserve not only the games themselves, but documents, paper, flyers, instruction manuals, cards of all sorts. These are things that get lost or thrown away, and they're gone forever. So that's really a valuable resource as well. And again, the idea is to celebrate and embrace what pinball's past was in the country and make sure it has a place in the future. Let's see. Pinball art also is a very important aspect of what we're doing. I think we've commissioned no fewer than 17 different murals hand-painted by artists such as Dan Fonce, Ed Castle, Eric Koss,
Darcy Bruno
most recently. And you could see about 13 of them hung in this year's show. Oh, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. And because the art, in terms of the art, I mean, science and history are pretty obvious with the laws of physics. You can teach kids, adults, about electricity, mathematics, geometry, the science part. The art is a bit more, I think, difficult to kind of explain or embrace, and that is the back glass is oftentimes reflected what was going on in the country at the time. So they're a reflection of pop culture. And that, by extension, leads to a better understanding of history. In terms of science and art, I'm going to let Mike talk more about the Metallica custom pin, because that was really an interesting project.
Hi. I think most of you know Wade Krause. He started making reproduction play fields, and he got involved in the Clear pinball project, and then he also got hired by an art firm, Electric Works, in San Francisco, and they started on the William Wiley project, and that was one of the first pinball machines to actually be presented in the Smithsonian and the National Art Gallery, along with the William Wiley collection, and they made about 7 or 8 of them, probably more, but nobody's talking. Those sold for $125,000 a piece, probably the most expensive electromechanical pinball machine ever made. The Metallica project was done privately for these rock stars. Metallica, I've never heard of them myself, but apparently they've got some money. No, they made two machines, and they are outstanding. I mean, these guys just spent so much time working on them, and we were lucky to get involved only with the fact that they parked it in our warehouse for a bit. And I remember when they had finally finished everything, I happened to be there, and I go, can I play it? And they went, yeah, sure, Mike. And so they let me play it. And then later they go, you know, that's the first time it's been played. And so I was kind of like really thrilled about that. What's happening is a kind of a renaissance of technology, and it used to take a whole factory to make a pinball machine. It's possible now. I mean, looking at what Wade and I have done, and what Wade and Dirty Donnie and Tanya Kleiss have done, Dan Kramer got involved, and they've taken an existing pinball and re-themed it and redone it, made their own toys and everything. But it's going to get to the point where we're actually going to be able to make our own machines, I think, if we so desire. Obviously, it takes a hell of a lot of work. But it is an incredible opportunity. And I think it's a great opportunity because the more people out there coming up with new ideas, I think will make pinball survive. Our museum's survivability is based on sustainability. And it was always kind of the juju aspect of it was, you know, hey, this was a Saturday night fun thing. We got into the serious end of it when we visited the Smithsonian, and there were no pinball machines there, and that floored a lot of us. We just went, this is a Smithsonian American Heritage Museum, and after a thorough search, we finally found one coin-op machine in the bottom floor, and that was a Ms. Pac-Man video game. And I just, you know, when we discovered that, it just kind of floored us. So we decided that we were going to do something about it. There have been, as Larry said, other attempts, but it's hard. I mean, wrangling pinheads is like, oh, herding pissed off cats, I guess. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to get all these people on the same page because there's a lot of soap opera and drama and everything. We like to stay clear of all that. We're pretty pure in our intent to just preserve these machines for America's future generations to be able to come in and play. We've seen what happens with jukeboxes. Is there a jukebox museum, really? I think there might be. I'm not sure. But a jukebox is just vaporized. The Europeans saw their value way before we realized that they had a potential value other than, you know, making music. And they bought them all. And the Russians are actually buying up a lot of our arcade machines. So we think it's really important to do this. So then the Clear Pinball was the first attempt to start to integrate some of what we want to do, which is survivability is going to depend a lot more on just letting people in to play games. If you want to get young people into it, then you can dangle the big carrot of amusement, but if you can attach it to some sort of educational value, we feel that this, in the long term, will guarantee our survivability. The hard part right now is coming up with content, curriculum. There's a lot in a pinball machine that can be used to teach. So far, the response has been so good that I've been teaching little classes in our art gallery about electromagnetism, about physics, to small groups, usually 15 to 20, sometimes as large as 30. But it's really difficult in our present location because we just don't have the room. Then I started on the Wade and my brother Christian and myself developed the Freedom series, and we just finished them up, so they're not completely finished. But one is an electromechanical Freedom pinball machine, and then the solid state version of the same game. The reason for that is to demonstrate the evolution of the switch to the transistor. Not only that, but the mindset, because you could build an electronic pinball machine using logic gates, et cetera, just like as relays. The pinball actually was one of the first devices to use computers and programs in a device that was marketed to the public. And, you know, we look at this stuff. We got our iPads and everything. We're going, big deal. Well, it's how stuff gets done. You got to look at what was before. And we feel it's really important to teach kids and anybody else who wants to learn about the basics of electricity. If you hand a kid a computer and go, yeah, this thing has electricity in it, they're going, oh, great, you know, and it runs in these little black chips with legs on them. But if you can demonstrate electricity, electromagnetism, and they start to get a grasp for something beyond this black box technology, and that's really important, especially in this day and age. We've got an associated. I'm going to turn this over to Larry because this is more his department. Is that okay?
Yeah, this is something that we've. Some of you have watched last night the documentary that we made in late July of this year with Wayne Nyan's interview. It's going to be showing tonight and tomorrow night as well. But it's something that we're calling our Pioneers of Pinball series, and that is we're trying to get on film and also audio recorded at least, you know, some semblance of some very key participants in the pinball industry. And Wayne Nyans, as you know, is one of the more prolific, if not the most prolific, pinball designer. He's 93 years old, lives in Mountain Home, Arkansas. He designed no fewer than 160-plus machines over a six-decade career at Gottlieb. So what we'd like to do is get other folks on film for our oral history project, and for example, Steve Kordek of Williams or Alvin Gottlieb, current designers, you know, George Gomez, and collectors, historians, et cetera. So this was the first attempt, and if you have time tonight or tomorrow, I'd encourage you to come and watch it. It's a really valuable research resource, obviously, because once those folks, with all the knowledge that they have and all the stories that they have and their experiences are gone, if we don't record them now, they'll be lost basically forever. And we're very fortunate to have Gordon Hasse, a very famous historian and writer. He's in our audience this afternoon. very significant collector and donor to the Pacific Pinball Museum of over 220 pinball machines of various manufacturers. Many of them are here at the show this year. Just to give you a brief rundown again on the Pacific Pinball Expo, this is the world's largest pinball show by far. We have close to 400 machines going back to the late 1800s to the modern solid-state games. Plenty of wood rails from the 30s through the 50s. Lots of seminars, pinball art, history, and repair. The back glass art murals, as I mentioned, we have 13 of those hanging up in the show floor this year. And some science exhibits in collaboration with the Exploratorium, and finally, tournaments. So really, it's a three-day celebration of like a one-way ticket to pinball nirvana. So say one-way, that's not round trip, because we're really trying to create that permanent state of what people like and enjoy about everything pinball. And oftentimes people come and ask us, you know, what's your museum going to look like when you have your permanent home? Well, it's kind of like what's right over there in the main exhibition hall with all the games set up and chronologically in different areas. You've got the murals. The only thing I think that we'd also have is a restaurant, a gift shop, oral history section, restoration classroom facility, maybe some storage space, and that kind of thing, all under one roof. If you can imagine what the Smithsonian has for, say, the Air and Space with the earliest Wright brothers, you know, and then the current NASA projects, all under one roof. That's exactly what we want to have, only with pinball. In terms of the milestones that we've achieved, this is our fifth Pacific Pinball Expo. We've recently doubled our square footage over in Alameda. We now have close to 100 games on free play. We are open 6 days a week. Significant acquisition was Gordon Hossie's generous donation to us, and upcoming will be games from Richard Conger, the Silver Ball Ranch here in Northern California. In terms of validation, we are financially solvent. We managed to turn a profit, and not a lot of nonprofits can say that. We are a 501c3. We have world-class historical information available. We have taken the Little Juju trailer to the Maker Faire over in San Mateo many times. We've won the blue ribbons there. And we are developing an interesting physics and science curriculum based on pinball. And that's really key, because if you want to get foundation money and grant money, you really have to develop the curriculum of what you're going to be teaching to kids and adults. But it costs a lot of money to develop those kind of programs, and a lot of energy and a lot of effort. So that's really key to the next step of where we want to go. So right now, the fundraising is really one of our main focuses. Now, that's not always easy to do when you're paying attention to art or science projects, because frankly, everybody likes to play pinball. And when you do things that aren't playing pinball, it makes it kind of difficult to get people's attention. But frankly, that's really where we're at, and it's really key to us. I don't know how many of you had a chance to go see our exhibit at the San Francisco airport. What was that, about a year ago? And no, it was about, what, the year before last, I think?
Yeah.
We had two 40-foot...
6 months, yeah.
Yeah, 2 40-foot glass cases with about, what, 40 machines in them?
Yeah.
From Humpty Dumpty to...
from Bagatelle.
Oh, Bagatelle.
To Twilight Zone.
That's right, Twilight. And it was really well-received, very, very popular San Francisco airport exhibit. We have had a speaker speak at the Smithsonian Institution. I think it was connected to the William Wiley project, Jim Dietrich. Here's a view of what some of the rooms are in the current museum. We have the solid state room, the historical room with the 50s and 60s games, the EM games from the 60s through 80s, the what we call the amusement gallery with some oddball games, some rifle games, some baseball games, clown games, various things. As Bally Spinner. No, no video games. You will not find video games in our Pacific Pinball Museum. That's a whole other topic. The next couple slides are about where we're going in the future and where we see our permanent home being. And I'm going to let Mike focus on that.
Thanks. Thanks, Larry. What we're trying to do at this point is we've been in Alameda because it's affordable. It'd be great to be in San Francisco, but the rent's a little too dear for us. And we're growing this thing in what we believe is a healthy manner. We call it an organic growth because we don't try to overspend what we have. We basically make it and save it. And we've been saving our money. And we were volunteer for so many years until we started becoming solid. And we were saving money, basically a rainy day fund. And then we were able to expand. And once that expansion happened, we were finally able to do a big part of our mission, which was to show all the eras of pinball. It finally allowed us to bring Larry's games and some of Gordon's games, which are the wood rails, which are pretty precious, into the museum. And the reason that was hard before is because, as you know, if you don't launch the first ball, the ball release gate stays open and it'll cook itself. Take some abuse, but not as much as the newer machines. We have to mother them. We have to, you know, be there and watch the public interact with them, because we get a lot of kids and we get a lot of people that have flipperitis, or everybody knows what flipperitis is, right? So we had to be there to basically make sure they didn't get beat up too much. And it's an ongoing process, but it's one of the only places where you can play these kind of games, and people are blown away and come from all over to play Larry and Gordon's games. So in doing that and getting trying to expand awareness of it and get more people to the museum, we did a Groupon. The Groupon was probably one of the most successful campaigns, not only for us, but for Groupon. It kind of surprised them how many we sold. We sold a bunch of tickets to Groupon, helped us financially, and it spread the word. And not only did all those Groupon people come in, but that it created a wake that sucked a lot of other people in. And all of a sudden, we were the cat's pajamas. And it went all after Christmas. There was one point Melissa and I, my wife Melissa, who's a big part of this project. I just said, Melissa, I think I'm going to have to shut the door because I don't think we can let any more people in here, because it was that packed, and it was amazing, and everybody was having fun. I've only seen one person leave the museum unhappy, or actually she was there and unhappy, and she was a teenage girl, 15 years old, on her cell phone and wanted to be with her boyfriend, and her father dragged her there. That was about it. Other than that, you know, you don't have this game or that game. Everybody that comes in there is pretty excited and happy. And the other thing I noticed is that more than 50% of them, I'd say, are not pinheads. And that's one thing I'm particularly proud of our organization for doing. We are bringing in people that do not play pinball. We're presenting it in a way. Well, let's face it. I mean, I used to be scared to go into some of the places that had pinball when I was a kid, and I always dreamed of a gentleman's pinball parlor, and that was, you know, and that was a long time ago. And then when Juju came around, my buddy Ed said, "Hey, Mike, you know, this is that gentleman's pinball parlor." And I went, "Oh yeah, I guess it is." You know, the idea is to make a nice place to play pinball. So back to where we are now. The success of the Groupon made us really popular. We got a lot of articles, and a lot of it, unfortunately, attributed it to me as the person behind the museum, and it's not true. I just had a little spark that lit the fuse, and we have so much help. The board of directors, everybody works so hard on this. I get to be the front man sometimes, and I get to take the credit, but it's really... a work of many, many people and a lot of hours to keep this museum going. I don't think people realize what a chore it is to, A, open 6 days a week, deal with the public. We pay staff, but not much. And everybody's doing this as a labor of love. And everybody believes in it, and that's why we keep doing it. We finally got an opportunity to talk with people from the city, and we had a storage space. We have 4,000 square feet. Then I managed to get another 4,000 square feet in a basically it was a I think a building where they stored paint. It's a bunker. It's cement. It'd be hard to blow it up. They had this one on the end become vacant, and that was the nice one that had it had heat. It had the nice. Nice bathrooms, a little kitchenette and everything. I mean, nice by the standards that we didn't have that stuff. So they wanted $2,500 a month for it. And I kept hammering on them, and they're just going, no, no, no. And I even they finally made a breakthrough. And then the realty company saw it and saw my offer, and they just basically doubled it and sent without my permission and sent it in. And at that point, I just blew a fuse. And I called up somebody from the city that I'd known, and I just said, look, I just think we're going to have to leave this town because this is, you know, we've brought so much to this little town. And it's not a big town. It's a unique town, and it's one that a place something like this would work really well in, but the city just wasn't getting it. And then an article in the East Bay Express came out saying that, yeah, we're thinking of moving to San Francisco or Oakland, you know, because they were offering us stuff. Well, all of a sudden, things started changing, and they accepted my offer, which was the same price we were paying for the other two spaces because they're exactly the same size. So now we have an additional 4,000 square feet that's going to be our restoration facility, and it's still secret, so don't try to find out where it is. And it's connected right next to our warehouse. We managed to get a great deal on some pallet rack shelving, and we're going to be getting Chris Kuntz has been instrumental in helping us get some of the materials that we need. One of them, watching what he does, is incredible. He's pallet racked all his stuff, so we said, yeah, that's exactly what we need to do. So we're palletizing things so that we can organize it and keep it totally preserved and in a controlled environment. Then the next step was to expand the museum so that we can offer an area to educate people, to do school kits. And we were so close. The people next door to us, where we are now after we expanded, we're having a hard time, and it looked like they were going to leave. It was a glass stained glass? Yeah, stained glass place. Real nice guy, but he'd been there 10 years, and he was about to give it up, and the landlord was, we were making negotiations. We were going to, again, add another 1,500 square feet. That was going to be our educational facility. After 6 months of waiting and everything, he finally came up with the money, and now he's got a bunch of jobs. So he's back in business. I'm really happy for him, but it kind of screwed us because we were really looking forward to, like, okay, we could stay here. This is great. But it didn't happen. So then I went back to the drawing board and said, well, we have to find a bigger place. And if it could have a restaurant in it and other accoutrements, it'd be great. This is the one I've been looking at for the longest time. And let me just go back one. It's how's that little laser thing? This is the front of the building. I shouldn't have done that. It's the rec center here. So it's a rec center, and what it is it was a 1,500 square foot bowling alley. So this part here is kind of exactly the same kind of construction that the Marin Exhibition Hall is. It's called a glue lamp tilt up. So there's no posts. It's totally open space. I don't know if a lot of you don't know, but I'm involved in the museum industry. I work with the Exploratorium, Chabot Space and Science Center. I visit museums all over the world, and I fix their exhibits. I saw this and I went, you know, the bowling alley had been removed, and I just thought it's perfect because it has, you know, you can do electrical drops, and it's just, it's perfect for a museum environment where you're changing things out. And it had no windows, which was perfect for pinball. It has a restaurant, which is all this part here. It's got modern bathrooms. This is built in 1975. This part of around here was a laundry. It's about 1,600 square feet, actually a little bigger. And we would use that as a on-site shop and classrooms to do classes in restoration and physics. This area here would be all exhibition area. We would have pinball machines. We'd have science exhibits. Working on a deal with the Exploratorium. They're buying one of our visible pins that we just made for negotiating a price that's close to $50,000 for it. They're hard to make. Everybody goes, geez. And what I'm trying to work out with the city is a deal where we raise the money to fix this thing up because they closed the base 14 years ago. Vandals took the handles. Scrappers took the copper. They came in there, and they just, you know, they beat the crap out of a lot of buildings. And this is one that I always used to come around and chase them away. Get out of here. I didn't. they kind of like, who the hell are you? You get out of here. So they unfortunately took a lot of the copper. But then when I looked at it, and I said, well, you know what? We need to rewire it anyway because the electricity is in the wrong place. So we Yeah, we got a building inspector in there to make sure the building was sound and everything, and we came up with a figure between $600,000 to $900,000, almost $1 million, you know, depending on how far you want to go, to restore it. And of course, the logistics of that is, well, okay, you don't even own the thing. Why would you dump that much money into it? Well, I looked at rent and how much rent we'd be paying on a facility of that nature. And usually it's going to run between $1.50 to $2 a square foot. At the end of 5 years, that adds up to, oh, I hope nobody does the math. But I realized that the savings that we do if we made an arrangement to where we got free rent in exchange for fixing it up, and after we'd use it for about 5 years and then spring into a bigger building is the idea. They have several buildings in Alameda. This is one. And the idea would be to raise the money to fix this up, have a semi-permanent location that is actually, and when most people see it, they go, well, this is a destination. It's right down from the Hornet, this isn't exactly right, but the Hornet is right here, and our building is right down there, right down the block from it. A lot of people come from all over to see the Hornet, which is the ship that carried Jimmy Doolittle's Raiders. Actually, it's the second generation ship that was named after it in honor. It's a ship that picked up the Apollo astronauts when they returned from the moon. It's got a lot of history for it. It gets visitors of about 100,000 visitors annually, and we'd be right down the block for it. So we would hope to sponge off of some of that. We already have some pinball machines on the Hornet, and I'm trying to get them to like put us on their website and everything. They're pretty slow moving. I know a boat's hard to turn, but these guys are even worse.
Michael?
Yes.
You mentioned you were sort of off frame. What's the rec center at? Is that not pointing at the building?
It is not. It is not. It's actually off screen.
Okay.
But Ron put this together for us, bless his heart, and I did not have a big enough image of that. It's hard to get stuff from the Navy. But it's in a, actually, this is land that has been claimed by the East Bay Regional Parks. So it's actually park area, and behind the building itself is all these barbecue pits and places for families to come out and have a little picnic, or and it overlooks the bay. It's got a southern exposure, One concept that I'm trying to sell them on is we'd like to rebuild this into a museum facility that we would use for 5 years, try to get funding for solar panels to solar panel it, because it's a southern exposure. It has it's on the bay, basically, so it would be ideal for a solar panel location. We had a building inspector come in and look at it to see how much of this was feasible, and he basically gave the building a clean bill of health and said the things that we wanted to do were pretty minimal, but the we would have to repair a lot of the vandalism. The back part mainly is a lot of windows broken in the restaurant area. Some of the plumbing's been, they scrapped the copper. So, but overall, it's really just going to be a lot of hard work. I rebuilt my Victorian house. It's the kind of stuff I like to do. We were going to make an arrangement to streamline the permit process and get the city on board to actually work with us instead of against us, and they seem to be coming on board. We handed them our business proposals because we've developed a couple of them, and one working with Gordon Hossie and one that we did on our own, and we're yet to give them some pretty pictures of what we envision can be, because I want to get them on board for us, and if they're going to, instead of wasting our time trying to come up with some pretty pictures and really sell them on it, I want to make sure that they're on board. After the expo, we have a meeting with the city manager, and in Alameda, it's not the mayor that wields the power; it's the city manager. Back in the 30s, they took the power away from the mayor because he embezzled a bunch of stuff to pay off his gambling debts. So they made a city charter to put the power into the city manager. So three board members are going to meet with the city manager and the assistant city manager and the city planner, who the city planner is one person who not only attends our museum, brings his kids, but also the city manager, I found out, has visited several times and brings his family to our museum and loves it. So this guy just came on board. He sees us as a vital part to breathe some life into an area that is incredible but is not utilized because they haven't been doing anything. They've gone through five developers, and there's been a problem with every developer. And so it's now time for Alameda to basically develop it the way we've developed our museum, which is organically. They finally figured out that no matter what developer they put in there, you got to understand, it's a Bay Area. This is prime real estate. It's right in the Bay. Alameda is an island that sits between, off to the side of Oakland, and you can see San Francisco's skyline from Alameda. And it's a unique little place. I always called it the Mayberry of the Bay Area, because it's the town that time forgot. People come over there and they can see all the Victorians, and they go, and they kind of like, wow, this is a throwback in time. And that's one reason that I thought it would be great to put a museum like that there. You go around, drive around, and see all the vintage automobiles that people have on the island, and all the old houses that have been restored and kept. So it's a good place to do it. Also, the weather is. It's one of the best places. That and Santa Clara have the best weather around in the United States. Michael? Yes?
Could you contrast the size of that bowling alley with the size of the room that the exhibition is in?
It would be about half the size, a little less than half the size of the exhibition hall.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a similar ceiling height to in here, about I think it's 15-foot ceilings. Yeah. So it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort and money to make this happen, and we are going about it in our unorthodox manner. Basically, we need financial help. We need physical help too, and we're going to need a lot of ambassadors, for one thing, to help push this idea along. We think that we could become the Smithsonian of pinball. This is a small start. If we can incubate get this going within a year to a year and a half, then the idea would be to use it as an incubator to develop curriculum for the science projects that we want to develop, the science curriculum for second and third grade, doing electromagnet theory. I'm sorry, second and third grade is, I'm going off of the national standards for what you're teaching in schools. So second and third graders, they want to learn about mass, motion, physics. And what better way than a ball in a box, you know, vectors, you get through all that stuff. Electromagnetism and electricity is fourth and fifth grade. I've already done a few, you know, small classes just trying to develop the content. And they eat it up. And it's just amazing. One of the best classes I had was just the Oakland YMCA. A bunch of kids came in, and after it was over, usually they can't wait to just go back and play pinball. But a lot of them stayed, and they wanted to know, how does that motor thing, can we see that? And I showed them how a motor could be a generator and how electromagnetism worked, and they got it. And so the concept is valid. This does work. And when you show them a flipper, and they go, well, yeah, how does that work? Well, this is an electromagnet, and you show them how when it's energized, it creates a strong magnetic field and pulls in the thing. This might be simple stuff for us, but these are kids. They're just learning. And one of our dreams is to develop games that kids will play and actually learn something. Say a simple thing like a plunger that you pull back and it launches a ball up on an arc. And you go, okay, well, what's that? Well, you make little targets that they try to shoot for. And so they do that. And they're just playing a game at this point. And they don't even know they're learning. And then afterwards they step back and they get a little, they go, yeah, what is this all about? And they start to learn about apogee and the decay of a projectile, you know, because of the force of gravity. You can throw math at them. There's just so much content there that could be exploited with using pinball technology, pinball machines, and the idea of using a game as a what we call stealth teaching. So they don't even know they're learning until they finish the game. They go, gee, I did pretty good. I wonder why. And they go, oh, it's because a magnet behaves this manner. You know, it's a very hard, difficult part. We wrote some grants to the NSF. They loved it, but we didn't. We don't have our walking shoes yet. They actually, two of them wanted to fund it, but one of them, you know, thought, oh, you know, what's the use of that? But they really encouraged us to please develop this and resubmit it, you know, when you have a further concept of it. So it's been validated on a lot of levels, and it's really validated by the fact that the Exploratorium, which is the leading museum for interactive science, is buying one of our exhibits and also working with us. So, to be honest with you, I don't know how to raise $1 million. I don't know how to raise the money. And
Tim Arnold did it. Just don't forget.
I know. And Tim, I kind of got involved with Tim's funding process because he was running it out of his barn for a long time, and I suggested that he rent a place, and he about cold cocked me, saying that rent—that's throwing your money down the tube. And I suggested, well, if you rent it, you might find out you're gonna make a lot more money than you're doing on these barn things, and it'll all equal out. Well, he did it, and he's done great. We need to reach out to beyond the pinball community. I believe we have to reach out to some major organizations and show them how valid this is. I think it's a prime time because America's really taken one in the gut. We've been hurting. And to me, pinball, I remember talking when Gordon Hassey asked my buddy Mac, Berkeley Mac, who got me into this, got the juju started. He goes, Mac, what got you into pinball? And Mac's a Berkeley radical. You know, he's you know, he's protesting the Vietnam War and blah, blah, blah. He's the most anti-American guy you'd think. And he said, well, you know, Gordon, my country was at war. We had a lousy president. We were killing people, and I didn't like that. I really didn't like. And I had to find something that I loved about my country, and I found it. It was pinball. And I, that, man, that cut right to my heart, because I said, you know, that is something that we, that is so powerful that we have about our culture. We've come up with something that I think could be, is something that we should be incredibly proud of. When we did the San Francisco airport and we brought out 8 machines to put around the column every day, and we watched people from all over the world, because this is an international terminal, and all the board members spent a day there, going there and showing people how to play. And these were wood rails all the way up. We didn't have any electronic, but it was all electromechanical from wood rails up to high hand, which would frustrate the hell out of everybody. And they loved it. And they, you know, then we tell them, well, you know, it's an American. Really? I thought it was European. You know, and I was surprised at how many people didn't know that the pinball, even though its origins were in France, the whole development of it and where it is today was all American. And it is so American, because it's like what culture would have enough time or impetus to create a box designed to amuse yourself, you know? I think that's like the pinnacle of engineering in my book. But anyway, I'm going to turn this over to Larry.
You know, we've been telling you this afternoon, it's really time to get serious about fundraising, because if we want to attract money from foundations and grants and large donors, we've got to have the curriculum and the science projects and the clear pins and other various exhibits, as it were, to be attractive enough to show that, yes, we can make this work. We've made it work. It's valid. We're self-sustaining. But in order to build that curriculum, that costs money. And it takes time and it takes energy. So when you ask yourself, how can you guys in this room help us? The answer is really just spread the word to folks you know, or people you wouldn't even suspect that might be interested. Maybe they're on a board of a foundation. Maybe they work for an expensive and deep-pocketed corporation that's looking to make donations of the size and the grants that we're talking about here. So be, as it were, an ambassador of pinball. While we're raising this kind of money and foundation awareness, it may be necessary to not put on the Pacific Pinball Expo, maybe for a year, because planning for this expo literally is a year-round effort. It takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of time, money, and if we're going to be directing ourselves toward fundraising in other venues, there just aren't enough hours in the day, quite honestly. And we're not quite sure if what that would mean, but if it's not something that we can do to the level of the standards that we've set so far, going back up to 5 years now, then it's really not worth doing. And I think we've set the bar pretty high as far as pinball shows are concerned. You've probably been to other pinball shows. I doubt you see the number of games. Maybe you see the seminars and certainly the industry insiders and designers, but you don't see the number of games all under one roof. It may turn out that maybe we can do something on a smaller scale, maybe not something as large, but we'll just have to wait and see. We really haven't made a hard and fast decision on that yet.
Our goal is
that's the other thing is, you know, if we've got the permanent home, then why on earth would you need to haul games out of there to a different venue, no matter where it is? This is a beautiful venue we have here with a hotel and Santa Fe, but we wouldn't need to do that. You just have it every year at your permanent facility. It's not to say this isn't a lot of fun putting this on. I mean, it's a great time. I think everybody really enjoys it. But as I said, what can you do? Really be an ambassador for pinball in general. Tell everyone you know about the museum's efforts. In terms of personally, what can you give besides cash? We're always accepting donations of games. Since we're a 501c3, you get a tax deduction on your taxes that way. If you have extra paper items that you, maybe flyers or photographs, anything pinball related at all, we'd love to have it. Volunteer your time and or your services. I'm looking around the room today. I see a lot of familiar faces of volunteers and some new faces too, so that's nice to see. But continue doing what it is you're doing. We really, really appreciate it, because it doesn't work without your energy and without your time. Buy PPM t-shirts and posters. Buy Gottlieb and PPM branded merchandise. Those of you who have been to the museum, you see we have an extensive collection of things for sale. And come visit us at 1510 Webster, at the corner of Webster and Santa Clara in Alameda. And most importantly, just go out and enjoy playing pinball every chance you get. It's amazing when I tell people what I do for a living, if I'm on an airplane or if I'm in a crowded airport bar or something, people say, what do you do? I said, well, I sit on the board of a Pacific Pinball Museum. Oh, well, hey, that's pretty cool. Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Tell me all about that. I love playing pinball as a kid. Oh, wow, how can I help? So you just never know who you're going to bump into and what people are thinking. But people, it's something that everybody, I think, we all agree, loves to do. But a lot of young kids today, they've never seen a pinball machine. They never actually had their hands on flipper buttons. They played a Sony or Wii or Nintendo or Xbox 360. The cyber version just isn't the same. And it's really exciting to see young kids come into the museum and also come to our expo and play pinball machine for the first time and see how wide-eyed they get. Once they're exposed to it, they love it. It's all a matter, I think, of exposure. Yeah. Do we have time for some Q&A, Ron? Okay. Yes, Randy.
Well, I'm having a hard time quite understanding if your plan to raise $1 million, put it into renovating this building that you're really only planning on being in for 5 years. That's a lot of dough for 5 years, and just thinking, and it's such an out-of-the-way venue for people to get to. It really have to be a destination. How does that compare with other potential venues that maybe you wouldn't have to put $1 million into, that is essentially going to be a temporary home, a stepping stone, maybe in a better location?
And that's a great question, and you get asked that a lot. Well, if you do the math and you're paying rent on a building, which is what we do, we're solvent, we're paying affordable rent. It's, we haven't gotten any discounts where we are on Webster Street. And you do the math, then over 5 years, it adds up to quite a bit of money. So the idea is we're kind of prepaying our rent, but we're getting a facility that is much better suited to our needs. It's not Alameda, it seems out of the way, but it is. A lot of people make it there. I mean, that was always a question. Was like, well, what, it's in Alameda. Well, it started there, and
but it's not just Alameda. I mean, nobody's going to see it driving by because it's so out of the way in Alameda.
I understand. Well, I guess the point to answer part of that is the Hornet, which is right up the street, gets 100,000 visitors a year. So they have freeway signage pointing everybody to the Hornet Museum. It's a national landmark. So they get the traffic. They've rebuilt the road finally. Things are starting to happen out there. So that it will be, there is more traffic going out there. They have a winery, a distillery, and now they're looking, they call it Booze Alley. So you have the Hornet, you have a bunch of hangars, and you have Rockwall Winery, which is one place we're considering to have a show there, because they've offered it to us for free. It's about 20,000 square feet. Next to that is a place where they are interested in us going into there, because it's going to be a brewery. And that's a possibility. Next to that is St. George's Spirits, vodka. What is that stuff? Absinthe.
Absinthe.
Oh, we have an absinthe drinker out here. No. Yeah, they're the only place that makes absinthe, and it's good, apparently. So and Alameda's trying to okay, so you get liquored up and then go to the Hornet, okay. and then people would eventually come over to our museum, which is on the main drag. kind of rather be part of that loop, you know, rather than have them go out there and then have to go back to Webster Street, because they usually don't make it to Webster Street, but a lot of them do. We see a benefit being out there because we would be able. It's in a little bit more remote area than the Hornet, because it's down from there. It's a soccer field where the point is that we could have we plan on having a lot of musical events as fundraisers there at the museum. And it's a location that really lends itself for people to come out there, have barbecues and things like that, and have a lot of mini fundraisers out there where we have the freedom to kind of do what we want. Why that building? Because it's because I know museums and how the flow works and everything. I kept looking for a place. One thing that's really missing, food and beer, beer and wine. People want to drink a beer while they're playing pinball. I don't blame them.
Imagine that.
Yeah, they maintain a soccer field next door, and we'd re-landscape it, and we get a lot of community help involved in this, because it's not just a project for our museum, it's also a project to breathe a little life into that area. So I don't know if I answered it exactly, but it is a destination, and you're right, that's what it kind of has to be. But just looking at what the Hornet does, we feel that, you know, if they're getting that many people, then we should be able to siphon off some of that.
Are there a lot of kids' leagues that use the soccer field?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's more than one soccer field on the island. There's quite a few.
And you'll be able to get signage near the whatever the highway or freeway?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, we already talked about that. And they already have the Hornet sign, so it'd be pretty easy to put the PPM sign right underneath it.
Yes.
I guess. Fantastic job, as always.
Thanks.
I'm not worried about your signage because in the social media era, you know, that's how people come in the door. Groupon proved that. And I think that the question, you know, because it's fabulous, this idea, is Alameda, I mean, are they able to come up with that free? I mean, well, because obviously I think about the National Pinball Museum and what they did, you know, what the mall people did to him, you know. So will Alameda commit to 5 to 7 to 10 years?
Well, that's the squirrely point. What I'm trying to do is negotiate a 15-year lease.
There you go.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. What I said 5-year. They have some funny rules, and I'm trying to negotiate a 15-year lease. If we restore it, we get it for 15 years for free. We will stay there for 5 years unless they revisit their they have some. Hey, Alameda's got some screwy laws. One of them is, hey, no pinball arcades. You know, and I find that out when I'm trying to get a permit for a sign, right? What do you mean? You know, been doing it for 8 years. They all look around.
Boy, surprise.
I pulled a couple pounds of cotton out of that seat, I'm telling you. I was a little nervous there. But just to answer your question, I think you made a very good point. In this day and age, GPS and everything, you know, that will lend to it immediately. That's how a lot of people come to us. It's not by signage or anything.
Not many people. Let's put it that way.
Most, I'd say 90% of the people that come there wanted to come there.
Exactly.
The people that walk by, they just want to look. Yeah. And they come in, oh, that's pretty cool. The people that are there, they want to be there. Gordon,
yes.
Sorry.
If I may, I wanted to make a comment, guys. I think the people in this room are what you could consider to be pinball-engaged people. And we're the beneficiaries of what this team of people have done. And it's very, very satisfying for all of us because we are pinball-engaged. But I think the subtext of what these two gentlemen are talking about is that the pinball-engaged audience will never be able to support the venture that they have on the drawing board.
That's correct.
The point that this is why it's so important for you folks to be ambassadors and to contribute in whatever way you possibly can. I mean, whether it's paper goods that you have and wanting to contribute, whether you know somebody who's a grant writer who might be willing to work with us on a pro bono basis, whether you're highly placed in an organization that has a philanthropic bent to it, any of these things, all of these things are going to have to happen. and the educational component that Mike was talking about, there has to be some social benefit for governmental agencies to want to get involved in something like that. They're not going to finance our clubhouse.
Right. Yeah, they that's exactly right. I to be honest with you, I'm kind of surprised that Tim Arnold has been able to get away with being a nonprofit this whole time, because he doesn't really follow the whole mindset of what a nonprofit does. Nonprofit puts money into its own organization to build it up bigger. Mm-hmm. He actually gives money to another nonprofit organization, and I don't know that that's going to work for very, very long.
That's our collective plea for participation.
Yeah, thanks.
Mark, you had a question?
I'm just curious. So, do you like sublet the restaurant? I mean,
yeah, we actually have a few people in mind to do the restaurant. They do great food. To run that. Now we'd probably do a percentage on the sale of liquor. Yeah, I mean beer and wine. I don't think we do liquor. And then the other thing is that we'd lease that out. There's a possibility that the Lawrence Berkeley Labs is going to build their campus right across the street. So if that happens and we didn't go for this, it would be kind of stupid. But yeah, Randy.
So what happens, you know, if things go according to your vision after 5 years?
Well, this is one plan, and Chris always be to negotiate it. But if we rebuilt it and had a 15-year lease, then basically we'd use it to develop our curriculum and gain status in the museum industry and the local nonprofit industry. That's a weird word for nonprofit. But basically raise our status up to the point where we will get people in San Francisco to go, hey, why don't you move that over here? Kind of like, you know, what's happening with the Hornet, unfortunately, you know, is like going, well, we could, you know, if we were over there. I don't think that's going to happen, because there's already a bunch of maritime stuff over there. And they do get visitors. And there is a certain advantage to being in Alameda. The rent is incredible in San Francisco. But the idea is to build ourselves up, build up our curriculum, build up our sustainability, so that we can go to a major city like San Francisco and be able to support ourselves. If we went over there now, we'd probably, you know, I hate to say game over, but let's just say there wouldn't be any extra balls.
It would definitely be a higher risk proposition doing that now, as opposed to a smaller step and interim basis of what we're talking about.
Cooperate with Musée Mécanique? Or is that just a...
No, they actually, when Musée Mécanique, I remember distinctly, my friend Damon, who's shooting video over there, he started one of the email campaigns. It's just when the internet started happening. He started an email campaign, because basically the Golden Gate Rec said, your lease is up and you're out of here, because we want to do something else. And everybody went, are you kidding? Do you know what Musée Mécanique is? It's like, we don't care. Get out. We want to rebuild the Cliff House restaurant, blah, blah, blah. They kicked him out. And it was an email campaign of all these signatures, you know, collected, mm-hmm. that finally got the San Francisco Historical Society to, like, go, well, we better do something about this, because they've got all the playland at the beach stuff. They've got all this incredible American art, folk art, amusement machines. These are things that were almost built like, they almost look like they were built in prisons, you know. But they're all, you know, like they're animated box. I don't know, you've been there. So
dioramas.
You see all the stuff. Well, all that stuff was just going to, you know, hey, that was one man's private collection. And, you know, somebody said, look, let's get him out by Fisherman's Wharf. And that's where they ended up. So
Are they paying commercial rates there?
They are paying... Yeah, they are. And we're going to do a little side thing with them because they had a little space, a little corner thing. But pretty darned expensive. I mean, it's Fisherman's Wharf.
So they can survive a coin drop at that location?
Not if you ask Dan.
So are they subsidized, or is there something else going on?
No, they're not subsidized. He does manage to to
there's a lot of foot traffic there, obviously.
Yeah, but obviously, you know, he has it's similar to us. He has a real passion. He always has.
The business model is different, right? Because you pay per game, whereas
that's correct. And well, now we actually have both. A lot of people don't know this. So Tim Arnold's always giving me crap. You got to coin your machines. You're not getting their value because you know when you play pinball, you're supposed to win something. And you know if it's on free play, what are you winning? Well, you know how many people come up to me and say, "Gee, I sure am glad these are on free play." I mean, I'd say 85% of the people. Well, heck, I mean, nobody actually complains about, "Gee, I really want to put that coin in." You know, so. Most people look at it as, wow, I don't have to put quarters in it. I can experiment. And that's what I tell people. I hear that a lot. You know, people just go, wow, really glad you guys free played this whole place because it allows me to experiment and visit machines I'd never visit.
Yeah, yes. And on that topic, you got to obviously know this, but Tim in Las Vegas can't operate older games. There's never going to be, you know, wood rails, or that by older I mean wood rails and before, in any quantity over there because the business doesn't sustain the maintenance they don't want it. The only way this retains the magic of your collection and the rest of it is by not coining the games. Now, if newer games were coined, yeah, but there's no way because if you were to actually figure out what a game should cost, you know, so you're already.
Yeah. Well, he already got sued by that nutball who was playing the bingo machines, and it didn't pay out, right? And he's putting nickels in the thing, and well, it didn't pay out. Yeah. Another thing is that we do have coin machines in the front because we do get a lot of people that, and they're the modern machines. Marcos gives us a new game every year to run for 1 year, and we get to keep all the quarters out of it. Last year it was Avatar. We got over $1,000 out of that, and we get visited by such notables as. Well, Andre Masenkoff basically attributed his world championship to our museum because he came up and thanked me, a couple of days ago. He said, "Mike, you know what the tournament final games were? Blah, you know this, and this, and those are the games at your museum." And so that, you know, I wailed on him because I come here and he plays all the time, you know. So he was he gave us a lot of credit for that.
He did.
So.
Anyway, I think they're giving us.
I think Ron's giving us a dirty.
So thank you again, everyone. And
thanks a lot. And thanks for coming to our expo.